Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Charles North, Associate Professor of Economics at Baylor University and the Associate Director of the Baylor Business Fellows Program. Chuck writes broadly in the realm of economics, with particular attention to how religion affects economic behavior and outcomes. He is the co-author of a volume on how faith intersects with economic and business concerns called Good Intentions, 9 Hot-Button Issues Viewed Through the Eyes of Faith. Depending on how it goes, we may have an opportunity to push some of those hot-button issues today. Professor North also holds a law degree from Duke University, making him a well-rounded scholar and somebody who is ideally suited to talk with us today about whether or not religion and or particular religious groupings play a role in promoting economic growth and the rule of law. Chuck, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
So you're an economist and a lawyer, huh? You must be invited to a lot of parties and just be lots of fun.
Absolutely. You know, people love both professions so much. I recall that when I was first practicing law and decided I might go off to graduate school in economics, I thought, what could I possibly do that would be less loved by the general public than a lawyer? And I thought, economist. It's perfect.
And then combining those two, well, you know, hey, but we show you a lot of love here at Research on Religion because we actually do love your research. And today we want to talk about the linkage between religion and economic growth or development, but with an eye towards what you consider to be a very important variable here, the rule of law. Now, a lot of folks, including many scholars out there, tend to see the religious realm existing separately from the secular economic world, and never the twain shall meet. But then again, we do have a pretty major historical thinker looming large in this debate, and that be the Max Weber back in the 19th century, who wrote all about this Protestant ethic thingy and how it led to the rise of the industrial West. What has the social science been since then and on this whole religion and economic nexus?
Well, Max Weber wrote right around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And I think a lot of people have heard of the so-called Protestant work ethic, and I think we get that terminology from Weber, but that's not actually what he was talking about. He discussed the idea of there being a Protestant ethic that he attributed primarily to Calvinism and to a lesser extent in Lutheranism. What he thought was happening was that the commitment of Calvinists especially to predestination and the individual's basic lack of control over their own salvation meant that it was important for an individual believer to demonstrate through some form or fashion that they were among the ranks of the saved. And so Weber postulated that within this Calvinist realm, and again to a lesser extent among Lutherans, that this desire to demonstrate that one was among the saved was done through being virtuous and frugal and prudent in how you conducted your affairs. It overlaps to some extent with the idea that service in the world was good service to the Lord as well. But it certainly was the case that Weber viewed Calvinists as trying to do well in the world financially as evidence of their salvation status in heaven. As a result, he contends that Protestantism in Europe created a culture that encouraged hard work, that encouraged investment in business, that encouraged saving, and that these things made what we call modern economic growth possible.
Those things all sound pretty straightforward, right? You save a lot, then you can invest in bigger businesses, the businesses grow, and all things sound pretty good with that. Weber ethic or Protestant ethic thesis seem to have fallen from grace, though, in the last, I don't know, half century or more. What's happening there?
Well, I think that it fell upon several problems. The first one was simply that he was not quite as accurate on his on the theology of it. It turns out that when you start digging around among prominent Calvinist preachers of the 19th century, you don't really find any greater tendency toward urging people to work. It's still very similar to the kinds of messages heard among other Protestants and even among Catholics. So just from a theological standpoint, there was a substantial amount of evidence that, you know, the Calvinists, while different theologically, were not tremendously different on this particular dimension that was so important to Weber's thesis. Then there were historical problems of which came first kinds of issues. Rodney Stark has done a substantial amount of work looking all the way back into the medieval period at how the Catholic Church was developing exactly the same kind of desire to invest and save and build upon what has been done, expand a business, expand into new technologies, and that all of it was done in monasteries. And I've done some research on this as well, and I have come to a conclusion fairly similar to Rod Stark's, which is, first off, always a safe thing to do.
Yeah.
But I have come to a conclusion similar to Rod's that the medieval monastery, which consisted, you know, of a group of monks set aside from the world, operating on their own landed estate, growing crops, producing products, and so forth. These medieval monasteries were what we would think of as a proto-firm. And these monasteries were setting up the kinds of behaviors that we see in a modern firm: consolidation of assets, careful management of them, specialization, division of labor, all of the things that economists talk about being things that the firm can do very well. We see that happening 800, 900 years before the so-called Protestant ethic began transforming Europe, according to Weber. Commerce develops in Italy. Commerce moves north in the late Renaissance. It moves north into Amsterdam and Holland. It moves into London. It moves into Germany. And so you see that the kinds of things that Weber is trying to explain on a very limited data set in Germany actually happened a lot sooner in other places and migrated into Germany. So I think there are some historical problems as well. Plus, when you get into the Western Europe region generally, you end up finding that not every Protestant region was really advanced at the time that Weber was writing and during the times that Weber is writing about, and some Catholic places were more advanced. So there's kind of this causality problem that falls apart with Weber. So where I've come down on it at this point is that Weber had a very good idea, and I think it's an idea that still influences us today. That idea was, surely something as important as religion influences the way people behave. Surely the way that people behave in response to their religious beliefs has an impact on society, on economic outcomes, social outcomes. And so I think that that notion of Weber's is still very much alive. And what we're doing today, and I think what I'm doing today, builds on that core idea of Weber. I think he simply had the mechanism linking Protestantism to growth wrong.
Well, before we get into what your specific mechanism is, we should talk a little bit about what other people have been finding and how that might then relate to some of the work you've done. We've talked on the show several times with a number of different people about how economists and social scientists more generally gave up on the religion variable for a good part of the 20th century. And I don't necessarily want to rehash those debates, but in the past, oh, I would say maybe 20, 25 or so years, there's been a rediscovery of religion on the part of social scientists, and then I guess the Johnny-come-lately folks have been the economists, although there's been some early pioneers like Larry Iannacone who have forged a path here. But not surprisingly, when the religion variable is rediscovered, economists grab onto that and say, well, we're going to explain economic growth because they're always interested in explaining why countries become wealthier or don't become wealthier. What are some of the other economists out there saying about this connection between religion and economic growth?
Well, I'll start with some of the more recent research that I think more directly engages the Weber hypothesis, and then I'll kind of build out from there, though chronologically I'm not doing it justice, right? Recent work by Ludger Wessmann and Sasha Becker on Prussian religiosity and education levels provides really good evidence that much of what Weber was pointing to within Germany, which I think was where his empirical work was done, much of the evidence from Germany really suggests, according to Wessmann and Becker, that the biggest impact that Lutheranism had was on education. So that you have an emphasis in Lutheranism, as in much Protestantism, on learning to read the Bible yourself. It's important to be able to access the scriptures for the individual to be able to understand what it is that the Bible teaches, and in order to do that, you have to be able to read the Bible. It turns out that learning how to read a Bible has a beneficial side effect, which is now you can read everything else as well. So that one of the biggest effects, according to Wessmann and Becker, was that Lutheranism induced people to learn to read, to gain literacy, and that the literacy allowed them to accumulate human capital. And this was a big driver of economic development in Germany, according to these two scholars. And I think the evidence that they've assembled on that is really very good. So I do think that this is probably one of the most important linkages that Weber didn't see between his observation, Protestant regions of Europe seem to be doing pretty well, and why that might happen. And I think that education is a big piece of that. Expanding out a little bit, we can look at historical accounts. Again, Rod Stark is probably a good example of one. He wrote a book a few years back called The Victory of Reason. And in that book, he argued, based on what I've already mentioned, the development of capitalism in the early medieval period through the church, through the monasteries, that the application of reason, and I think sociologists would call this rationality, economists would simply refer to it as optimization, that through this application of reason and optimizing behavior to the way that they conducted their affairs, they developed this mode of operating in economic realms that, from which capitalism developed, ownership of property, applying it to develop the land and to develop techniques that will generate profit, support more and more people, create jobs, create opportunities, even induce new technological innovations. And so I think that Stark basically tracks that from the early medieval period up to modern times and attributes much of what's happened in capitalism to those early developments within the church, the Catholic Church in the medieval period. A counterexample almost is a gentleman that I'm pretty sure has been on Research on Religion before, Timur Kuran. And Timur's work has focused on almost the negative of what I just described with Rod Stark's work. He's asked, why did the countries where Islam is predominant not develop as quickly? And a lot of it he ends up attributing to institutional factors associated with Islam, with the religion of Islam. So that rather than it being the teachings of Islam itself, there were certain aspects of it, especially the inheritance system that's set forth in the Quran, that limited the ability of firms to develop and grow, for capital to be concentrated and put together, and wealth to be employed in the same kinds of ways that it was done in Western Europe. And so it's not so much that Christians could do something and Muslims couldn't, it's that the incentives just weren't there for the Muslims to do what the Christians were figuring out how to do. And then much more recently, we've had, well, not more recently, but a more economics style with data and hypotheses and things like that. Robert Barrow and Rachel McCleary wrote a paper, it's 10 years ago now, a little bit more than that, that it came out.
But on the geological timescale, that is relatively recent.
It's relatively recent, yeah. But in the economics of religion timescale, it's practically prehistoric,
yeah.
which is more of a comment on the nature of the economics of religion than on the nature of history. Robert Barrow, Rachel McCleary had a paper that came out in 2003 where they were seeing whether certain religion variables had an impact on economic growth in a series of cross-sectional regressions for economic growth. These really built on work that Barrow had been doing throughout the 90s to explore, in general, what are the things that are associated with economic growth. Why do macroeconomies grow? What hinders them? And a lot of it then is aimed at how can we, if possible, help third world nations develop and move forward and enter the first world. Mm-hmm. This paper that they did had to me what still are some unusual, or not unusual, but just kind of odd findings. One doesn't seem so odd. It was that belief in heaven, but even more particularly, belief in the existence of hell, are positively associated with economic growth. And they took that finding as being somewhat supportive of the Weber hypothesis, that when people are worried about going to hell, they'll be better, they'll behave nicer. When people behave more nicely, they engage in cooperative behavior, the kind of behavior that allows people to overcome prisoner's dilemma problems, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with what that's about. Mm-hmm. So we have that finding. And then they also found that essentially given a level of belief in a society, increased church attendance reduces economic growth.
That's because you're spending so much time Sunday just waving your hands and not building gadgets and gizmos.
I think that's basically what they argued, right? Mm-hmm. Was that if you're going to church a lot, you can't be working and producing, and so it holds back the economy. But again, that's holding constant for a certain level of belief in heaven or hell. I think one of the things that was missing from their reasoning in that paper was how exactly do we generate the beliefs in heaven and hell in the first place? They don't arise in a vacuum. It's the participation in religion in whatever form your religion takes that generates those beliefs. And so there are some just basic equation specification problems in that paper that I don't think were ever really fully worked out, at least at that time.
Yeah, that does make sense, because we do, as you note, learn about heaven and hell by going to church a lot, and those who tend to go to church a lot are going to be more imbued. We kind of know this as a sociological fact, or even just a casual stylized fact in our daily life. Those who go to church a lot tend to know that churchy stuff a lot more, and if belief in heaven or hell has some impact, you would think that there's some maybe linear, curve, a linear relationship. Although I guess it could be a threshold, is that if you just initially believe in hell, whether or not you go to church or not is going to prompt you to cooperate with others, avoid doing bad things, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think so. And I guess there's this idea that you might start believing in hell just because of general cultural influences without having to go do specific religious education to learn it. But I suspect that such an effect would not hold up after a few generations, and that as the learning about heaven, hell, Jesus, and the devil in a Christian society, for example, as those things wane and people aren't learning that anymore, I think that the cultural influence would also not be as strong. So I think there's an important question as to how you actually generate those beliefs, if the beliefs, in fact, are positively associated with economic growth. For me, though, what came out of that paper for Barrow and McCleary was simply the idea that it does appear that somehow or other, religious beliefs and religious attitudes are associated with economic outcomes at the macro level. There were, and then I'll mention a couple of others. There was a study by three Italians, Giso, Sapienza, and Zingales, where they did an analysis of survey responses asking questions about attitudes and beliefs toward economic things, trade, trust, your attitude toward government and the role of government, your attitude toward commerce and capitalism, and a whole bunch of questions on things like that coming out of the World Value Survey, which is a data set comprising, at the time they did it, about 60 nations. And they concluded from their analysis that religious people had different kinds of beliefs about some of these things than non-religious people did, and that on balance, though it varied somewhat by religious group, on balance they thought that the religious people had attitudes that were more positive toward fostering economic growth than non-religious people did, at least within that survey set of the World Value Survey at the time that they did it. And then I'll mention one last one, which was a paper by Joe Daniels and Mark Vonderer, who I think also have appeared on your show before.
They have.
Did a similar kind of analysis just looking at United States believers. And they also found that different types of religious people had different types of attitudes on immigration and on trade, on imports in particular, where the more conservative Protestants and the more conservative Catholics tended to be more in favor of import restrictions, less in favor of immigration, and the more liberal Protestants and the more liberal Catholics had opposite kinds of attitudes. But that religiosity, the degree to which you actually attended and participated in the religions in the United States, affected the extent to which you held those beliefs. So all of these studies combined made me start wondering, well, is there really a religion effect or not? And if there is one, why? What's the causal linkage really between these papers that are starting to find suggestions that religion is correlated with economic growth outcomes and the way that it actually happens?
So let's dive into your paper here, and your paper is building upon and following a lot of these previous works, as you mentioned here. And I know that economists like yourself, you like to think about economic outcomes in a number of different perspectives. You like to think from the macro perspective as well as the micro perspective. And a lot of what we hear on television and the radio pundits talking about is usually the macro economy. We're dealing with things like GDP, gross domestic product, unemployment, trade balances, and that. And there's this tendency among economists, and you mentioned in Barrow here, he does a lot of this stuff, is to look for correlates between these macroeconomic outcomes, you know, increases in GDP, and then a variety of various correlates here. And your paper, which we're discussing today, and I should mention the title of it, it's called Religion, Corruption, and the Rule of Law, and that's in the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking. It takes on this methodological approach. You pick up some large data sets here. And I want to start off by looking at the larger macro issues here. I think you opened the door to some interesting micro findings, but let's take a look at this bigger macro stuff first. And even though that you're focusing on rule of law, there is a goal still that's out there to explain economic growth. You connect rule of law and economic growth, and I'll let you do that here in a second. But economic growth is this big, huge topic. A lot of macroeconomists do this. They pull down data sets from the World Bank or the IMF or other places, and they put this stuff in an equation and run some formulas on it. How do economists go about measuring economic growth? What is GDP?
Well, GDP is an abbreviation for gross domestic product. And as it happens, this semester I'm teaching a one-semester survey of micro and macro economic principles to a predominantly freshman class. And yesterday we began the macro section, and the very first thing we talked about was GDP. So what gross domestic product is a measure of the market value of all final goods and services produced in a place in a time period. So if we were looking at U.S. GDP for a year, it would be the market value of all of the final goods and services produced in the United States during that year. And so there are some kind of technical terms there. The market value refers to prices. So GDP is measured in dollars. And the way that we do that is we figure out as best we can how many trucks and how many cantaloupes and how many bushels of wheat and how many computer programs and how many haircuts were created in the United States during a year. And there's a substantial, you know, survey infrastructure that the Bureau of Economic Analysis uses to do this. The problem is you can't add up haircuts and cantaloupes and wheat and cars and trucks, right? Those are not additive units. So we convert them to dollars by valuing them at the price that they sell for. And then you add that up, and you have it within all of the things that were produced for final consumption in a year in a place. Now, what I mean by final consumption is simply this. Let's think about a bushel of wheat. That's a bad example. Let's think about corn. If you go to the grocery store and you buy a few ears of corn and you take them home and you cook them on your grill or you cook them in your pot and boil them however you want to cook some corn and you eat them, you're the final consumer of that corn. And so the value of that corn, in theory, is included in the gross domestic product of the United States for the year that you purchased it. If Frito-Lay goes and buys a whole bunch of corn and roasts it and grinds it up and turns it into Fritos, right? That purchase of corn by Frito-Lay is not a final good. It's an intermediate good. And then they produce the Fritos, which are then bought by the consumer, and the consumer product is the final good. So whoever the final user of the product is, that's the transaction that's included in GDP. And it essentially includes all of the work done along the way by all of the various contributors to the product. So the farmer's value is included in the price that the farmer sold his corn to Frito-Lay. There's value added there. Frito-Lay bought the corn, mixed it with other things, and created another product, and there's value added. And all of that value added gets captured in the final price. And that's really what GDP is. It's a measure of market transactions of final goods and services.
I want to bring this up and connect it back to religion. We were joking a little bit earlier about the barrel piece and how the belief in hell or a church attendance decreases GDP because people are spending more time in church and not buying Fritos or boiling corn in their on their oven or in their on their stove at home. And this is where, you know, increasingly as I study this stuff and think about it, I become a little bit skeptical about what GDP is actually telling us, because when I think about going to Sunday services, that's something that we produce in society, and there's an exchange that goes on there. There's a minister who specializes in learning about the Word of God, and he thinks about it all week, and then on Sunday he appears and he says, "Oh, let me tell you this lesson about Noah," or "I'm going to read to you from the Gospel of Luke this week," and we'll talk about that. And that has some benefit, but that's stuff that really doesn't show up in GDP. You know, and this is where I think a lot of people get this divide between, well, there's the religion realm and there's the economic realm, the secular economic realm, and those twain shall not meet. But nonetheless, it seems that that stuff should be counted in GDP, and it's not. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right that that stuff creates value. And what GDP is trying to do is come up with a measure of value produced in the society. And so the way that GDP is constructed, you know, across countries automatically leaves out certain kinds of things. There's just no question about it. It automatically leaves out the benefit and joy you get as a believer in participating in religious services. Now, I would assume that the salary that gets paid to the pastor, you know, the money spent by the church gets counted into the GDP. But the reality is that the believers are probably getting more value out of church than, you know, the dollar sum that gets spent by the church. So I think you're automatically losing what we would think of as consumer surplus, right? The GDP measure is not capturing the gain that I get from having a pizza that I would have enjoyed for $15, but I only had to pay $9 for, right? It's not picking that up. GDP is not picking up the value of hanging out and sitting around and watching TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an enjoyable thing. It's leisure or the fun I had on going on vacation. It'll pick up the money I spent while I was on vacation, but it's not going to pick up the fun that I had. It's not going to pick up the value of anything I make myself. When I clean my own house, right, that creates value because a cleaner house is a nice thing to have. But I didn't pay anybody to do it, and I didn't. There was no market transaction. I simply did it myself. GDP is not going to pick up that. We call it household production. And so the value of household production is not going to be included in GDP. When you start talking about a developed country versus a less developed country, that becomes a real problem because in less developed countries, you're going to see individuals with plots of land behind their homes where they grow their own food and they consume the food that they grow. So they'll be producing food, they'll be eating food, but it won't be entering the market. So it will not be included in the GDP calculations of that country. Another thing that tends to pop up that is not included in GDP and will make a difference in when you're trying to do comparisons across countries is the informal economy. I think in general we can call it the informal economy. Part of this will be criminal behavior. The BEA makes no attempt to include the value of illegal drug sales in the United States GDP. So criminal activity is not included, but also informal activities are not included, things that don't go through a formal market. And one really good example that I always point out to my college students when they start feeling very superior about never having participated in informal economies, I point out to them that if you were ever a babysitter who babysat for someone's kids, was paid in cash, and didn't report it on to the taxing authorities, you participated in the informal economy. And again, there's a price, there's a market, but it's an informal market, and it just isn't included in the surveys. There's a lot of stuff that gets left out of GDP. You're absolutely right about that.
I also bring this up because people do a lot of volunteer work at churches. They help landscape or they, you know, gather and fold clothes that are distributed to homeless individuals or something like that. And a lot of that doesn't get picked up either. And to the extent that you have a very vibrant economy or, excuse me, a vibrant religious economy with lots of people going to church and doing those kind of things either on a Sunday afternoon or maybe even during the weekday, you don't pick up a lot of that stuff.
Right. So the GDP measure is not going to pick that up. And so I suppose that we could ask if this means that increasing GDP is really not a goal that we should be pursuing, right? Because GDP is such an imperfect measure and so forth. And that's kind of where I fall back into my economist logic. GDP is not perfect, but it is really highly correlated with all kinds of measures of human well-being. Places that have higher GDP have lower infant mortality rates. They have longer life expectancies and, generally speaking, better health outcomes. They have typically less conflict and less internal conflict. So on all of these measures that people really would care about, the countries that have higher GDP per capita are going to have better measures on these other dimensions as well. The correlations are incredibly high. And so I think the fairest thing to say when we look at GDP as a measure of well-being, what we're really doing is we're trying to proxy a general state of well-being, and we're using GDP to do it.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, and that's where you come into this issue. And I know a number of macroeconomists and economists more generally, even microeconomists and things like that, they like to figure out what increases that GDP, because it does affect a lot of other things, infant mortality, living standards, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's economists have used a whole mess of different things. They put in different policy measures, they put in human capital measures, factor endowments, you know, how much iron and coal you might have sitting in your ground in your nation, all these different things. But increasingly, there's been attention given to some of these basic governing institutions and how that affects GDP. And that is where you come in, because you focus on not so much explaining religion and economic growth, but religion and the rule of law, or its flip side, the lack of rule of law, which we oftentimes call corruption. So tell us a little bit about how rule of law relates to economic growth and why you consider it to be a rather important variable. And then also give us a sense of what corruption is based upon your conception of rule of law, because I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between our popular understanding of corruption and what an economist who studies rule of law might be.
Right. So when we were first thinking this project up, and to be perfectly honest, the paper that came out last year has been, you know, in progress for a really long time because of iterations through the journal process as well as iterations through the authorship process. But we were trying to figure out why religion might have an impact on economic growth. What is it about religious belief and religious practice that might encourage economic growth? And one idea that Carl Gwynn and I, my co-author, hit upon was this notion that, you know, maybe it just makes people behave better. Maybe if you truly believe your religion and you truly act on the religious teachings, you'll just behave better. And you won't be as much of a troublemaker. You'll be less inclined to commit crime. You'll be more honest. You'll do these sorts of things. And that is leading into this idea of rule of law. When we went looking for measures of rule of law, we found, obviously, an index that we use, but I like the way that they defined rule of law as they were constructing their index. As these guys conceived of rule of law, and this is what we adopt in our paper, it's a measure of several things, largely the extent to which people in an economy believe in and follow the rules that govern a society, which of course means there have to be some degree of rules as well. So the rules deal with several things most commonly. First, it's property rights. How well are property rights protected and respected by government? How well are property rights enforced? So if someone steals your things, if someone encroaches on your land, how well are your rights protected as against that particular encroachment? How well are contracts enforced? Do people really live up to their contracts? And if someone does break a contract, how hard is it to enforce in a society? How strong are the courts? How strong is the legal infrastructure? How strong is the crime prevention and crime enforcement infrastructure? These are the kinds of things that we're looking at with rule of law. And combined, what they're getting at is that people in a society where there is a rule of law know that there are rules, that these rules govern their interactions, and that they can rely on and count on these rules to be both, you know, at least somewhat fair and definitely predictable, so that you know how things are going to be enforced, how your rights are going to be protected. That's what we think of as rule of law. And so what we thought was, if you have a bunch of religious people who are already sort of naturally inclined to honesty, who are already naturally inclined to following through on their promises, who are naturally inclined to not commit crimes, it should be a lot easier to have rule of law in a society given your resources, right? That all of these things impact the ability of a society to do those things.
You don't have to have police on every corner monitoring every single rule. You're just going to trust people that they're going to follow things. And, you know, when you make a contract with another religious person, a handshake might do rather than having a large, burdensome court system examining every single line in it.
Exactly. Right. And so on the one hand, it's a transactions cost issue. It's simply not as costly to do business. It's not as costly to live your life. Again, another example I give my students of this is imagine when you go into the grocery store. The vast majority of people who walk into a grocery store in the United States are not contemplating stealing anything. They are respecting the property rights of the store. Their intention is to go in, get the things they wish to purchase, take them to the front, and pay for them. Now, there's a subset that don't intend that, and they would try to steal if they could get away with it, and they do try, you know, that it happens. But the fact that so many people basically go in fully expecting to comply with the rules means that the store doesn't have to spend anywhere near as much on security as you might have to in a much less compliant society. They don't have to have security guards watching you. They don't have to keep the merchandise hidden in the back and pay for it as you get it, right? These kinds of things, I think, facilitate commerce, facilitate trade, and mean that we can spend more of our resources on production rather than on protection and security. So that was the idea, right? If you've got a bunch of religious people, they will behave in certain ways that make it easier to have rule of law in a society. You need less resources to enforce behavior because there's less bad behavior, and people are generally more compliant anyway.
Now, what do you mean by corruption here? I just want to bust in because corruption would seem to be the flip side of it, but it does have a specific definition or conceptualization within your framework.
Right. Corruption, as we use it in the paper, is not purely the flip side of what I just described. It's related, obviously, and they're very closely related. But it focuses more on corruption within the governance system. So within the government at all levels, are there people who are taking advantage of their public position and the power that they have through their governmental authority? Are they taking advantage of that to enrich themselves privately? So it's using public power for private gain. So we're really focusing on governmental corruption, and it takes a broad array of possible actions. It can be the need to grease the wheels with a bribe to get something done. It can take broad-level corruption where a ruler and his cronies basically skim the natural resources of a country and with their oil deposits or their natural gas deposits. They skim from the profits of that and deposit them in private banks in the Caymans, or I guess to a lesser extent anymore in Switzerland. But you know, it's how do you sort of create wealth out of your public position? And typically what we think of corruption then is that you have someone in power over society in a political system who is able to use that power to benefit themselves rather than focus on the benefiting the masses.
Yeah, tinkering around with the rules in order to manipulate them in your favor.
Absolutely, and I think one way that this is related to rule of law is that sometimes what you do if you wish to engage in corrupt activity is you create a lot of rules that are really technical and difficult to comply with so that it's easier for somebody to basically bribe you to ignore the rules than to actually comply with them.
Yeah, we call that rent seeking.
Exactly.
In rent creation. In
exactly.
The world of economics. So this is what you're after, and I can see clearly how rule of law is going to affect economic growth. There's going to be less deadweight loss. Transaction costs get lower. Corruption creates uncertainty, creates more deadweight loss, et cetera, et cetera. What do you do or what do you find and how do you find it with respect to connecting religion, religious beliefs or religious institutions to this rule of law and corruption stuff?
Right. So what we figured was that if religion could impact either of these variables, then that may be at least one linkage between religion and economic growth outcomes. So we decided that what we would do is take what had been kind of an independent variable in economic growth regressions, which were these rule of law and control of corruption, and see if religion affected them, leaving, of course, aside the question of then how much of an effect passes on through to economic growth. That would probably be another paper that I would have to work on.
Yeah, but it's nice that you're doing this. You're just basically busting out one variable and saying, hey, let's really look at the link.
So we're saying we know there's an extensive literature showing that these kinds of factors are positively and negatively associated with economic growth, rule of law positively, corruption negatively. Let's grab some variables that measure this, and we found some really nice indices that were done by some World Bank researchers where what they did was find a whole bunch of other indices on rule of law and on corruption. So they found about as many as they could find and then compiled them into a single index. So what we have here really is an index of about 10 to 15 to 20 other indices. So they've compiled and combined a whole bunch of more narrow and specific things into broader measures of rule of law and control of corruption. And they really work fairly well, I think, at capturing what they're trying to measure. So we took those and, you know, in a very technical sense, we put them on the left-hand side of the equation. This is the thing we want to see what factors affect it. And the first thing we did was acknowledge that if you are a richer country, it's a lot easier to have rule of law. You can have more, it's easier to pay for courts, it's easier to pay for police, it's easier to pay for all of the things that go into rule of law. If you are a richer country, it makes less sense for somebody to be brazenly corrupt because you have other sources of income as a public official than simply bribery and other forms of corruption. You can first off, get paid more, most likely, but then also there likely could be graver consequences. Your opportunity cost of being bad is higher. So we know that having a rich country makes it easier to impose rule of law and makes it easier to control corruption. But the problem was, having less corruption and having rule of law also makes you a richer country.
It's endogeneity, as they say.
You've got this endogeneity problem, a circular causation problem. So we did what economists normally do, which is come up with some instruments for the GDP measure. And we use things that are pretty tough to argue against their exogeneity. We looked at the latitude of the country's geographic center, whether it was in the northern or the southern hemisphere, whether a country's borders are landlocked or not, and the portion of the country that has arable land, or it included orchards and groves and things like that. So basically the agricultural productivity of the land, what percentage of the country is productive.
Yeah, I should just pull a tangent out here, and I don't want to discuss this very deeply or even at all, but I point some listeners in this direction. There's a whole interesting literature on geographic location and economic development that focuses on a lot of this latitude stuff. And, you know, at first you tip your head and you go raw and try to figure out why would that even matter? But it's kind of interesting. You would think that countries that are tropical would be, you know, very good at producing agricultural products. But it turns out that the farther you are away from the equator, the more you have to invest in technology and capital in order to turn over the land and to make it productive in those cold seasons, et cetera, et cetera. And that it kind of, you know, some people have argued that that stimulates growth, which is kind of an interesting thesis.
Yeah, and I won't go too deep into it. I've been somewhat profoundly impacted by Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel explanation of sources of agricultural technology being related to geography as well. What I think, I'll quickly sum up a piece of the literature you're referring to. One of the problems in the tropics is simply that it never gets cold. And since it never gets cold, the bugs never die. And when the bugs never die, they are more inclined to give you diseases. And so tropical diseases are much more of a problem than similar kinds of diseases are in more temperate climates. And so that alone means that your human capital is in better shape in more temperate climates because it's less inclined to being sick.
Okay, so we'll just move on from there, and people who want to investigate that can check out the additional literature. But this religion thing, right? Yeah. How do you factor religion into... So you got all your good control variables, attitude, and that kind of stuff, but religion...
So we added in, basically, we explored other control variables that were kind of human development things, the infant mortality rates, median age, other sorts of things that would seem to make some sense. They were also highly correlated with the GDP that they didn't really add anything to the model. So we really stripped the econometric model down to just our GDP with the instrument variable being instrumented by those variables I mentioned a while ago. And then we added in some measures on religion. And this was really the puzzle, because how do we do this exactly? Fortunately, there is a data set out there, and I think we'll probably be chatting about the quality of these data in just a minute. There's a data set out there that is currently available online called the World Christian Database. It's an extension of a project that came out in two editions in 1982 and then again in 2001 called the World Christian Encyclopedia. And these researchers, David Barrett and, let me get their full names. I know that the third person is Todd Johnson and the second author is... I'm having trouble turning pages now.
Yeah, we'll link to it.
George Currian, David Barrett, George Currian, and Todd Johnson have done these two volumes of work where they've done essentially a description of the religious, the state of religion in every country in the world under current borders. And this entails a number of things. They've combed through survey data, they've combed through everything they can get their hands on as well as history to write encyclopedia entries country by country that describe, you know, what kind of people are there, what religions are they, what's the traditional religion, what's the relationship between church and state in this country, blah, 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 lots of things like that. And then they've got these marvelous tables. If you're an empirical social scientist, your eyes are drawn to them. And these tables, the ones we used, are the author's assessment of the number of people in each of about 27 religious groups in several different time periods. The earliest time period that they attempted to estimate populations of countries and how they break down across religious groups was 1900. And then they have estimates again in 1970, in 1990, in 2000, and then some projections going forward as to what they think is likely to happen, I assume based on fertility rates and so forth, possibly immigration rates. We grabbed on to the 1900 numbers, so how many people are in each religious group in each country in 1900, and we also grabbed on to how many were in each religious group in 2000.
Now, I got to stop you here because this is one of these things, and I have to admit, full disclosure here, I've used these data set, and I've gone back to the 1900 data as well. And the question that always comes up is, whoa, the world in 1900 is very different than it is in 2000. Even Poland existed, then it didn't exist, and then it existed, then it changes borders. There was a Germany, there was a Prussia. You know, it changes all the time. And then, you know, mid part of the 20th century, you get decolonization. And then there's a whole new array of borders and countries, et cetera, et cetera. How do you deal with that?
Well, I don't know how I deal with that, but I'll tell you what they did. The authors of the World Christian Encyclopedia and the creators of the World Christian Database hold the borders constant to current borders. Now, how did they do that going back in time to assemble the data? Honestly, I don't know in detail how they did that. I think the best thing I can say is I'm taking on some degree of faith that they did a decent job at it.
Yeah, and again...
But they did work very hard to try to do it within the framework of modern borders. So they're trying to keep the borders constant over time. And they're looking at the geographic location, even if it wasn't a polity at the time.
Yeah, and to their credit, they put in a monumental effort to do this. And one could easily criticize them saying, well, it's not 100% perfect. We can nitpick here, there, or everywhere. But you know, bottom line is it's some really interesting data that seem pretty valid, seems pretty reliable over time, too. There's a difference between validity and reliability. It seems pretty good. So, yeah.
I agree. And one of the ways that we soften the need for precision in their work when we put it into our paper was we created actually a very blunt variable. What we ended up doing was, based on the numbers that were in the World Christian Encyclopedia, we coded a series of dummy variables, so 0, 1 variables. The variable in each country took on a 0 or a 1 value, which was equal to 1 for a particular religious group if that religious group was the largest one in 1900. So in the United States in 1900, the largest religious group was Protestants. So we have 11 variables, Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, and some more. And for the United States in 1900, all of those variables are equal to 0 except for Protestant, which is equal to 1, indicating that Protestants were the largest in the United States. But in China, for example, the largest in 1900 was something that they called Chinese folk religion. And we lumped that in with a category that we called Asian ethnic religions. And that picked up several other countries as well, that the largest religion in those countries in 1900 was one of these Asian ethnic religions or a Chinese folk religion. So that's what we did. Each country, we found what the largest religion in 1900 was based on their data. We found what the largest religion was in 2000 based on their data, and we gave that religion a 1 and all the rest of them a 0 for those particular years.
Okay. And
that's how we measured religion.
Yep. And so what do you find?
What we did then was we stuck that into our regression analysis, our equation, with the GDP estimate, and we put rule of law on the left-hand side to see how much having Protestant equal to 1 altered the estimate of rule of law, given a particular level of GDP. That's roughly what we did. What we found was that when you use the classification of countries from 1900, so we look back to the 1900 data, we find out what the largest religion was in 1900. What we found was that the countries that had a Protestant largest group, a Catholic largest group, and this was the surprise to me, a Hindu largest group, were significantly higher in rule of law than any country that had Islam as its largest group, an African ethnic religion, or, and this one also surprised me, or an Orthodox Christian religion. Okay, so the Protestants and Catholics were at the top. The absolute bottom were the Orthodox Christians. And that surprised me because what it said is that there's not something unique to Christianity. It's Western Christianity that was associated with higher rule of law. And Eastern Christianity was actually at the bottom of the barrel.
Why do you think that is? I mean, for me, if I had to posit an explanation for this, Eastern Orthodox churches tended to be captured by the state, by the government, at a much higher rate than, say, Catholicism or Protestantism, both of which were captured by the state in many regards. But it seems that the connection between church and state in Eastern Orthodox religions was much more tightly controlled than I would say in the West. Is that a possible explanation?
Actually, I think that is almost, I believe that that is the reason, though there's a little bit of a complicating mechanism in there that relates to another paper that I think you're planning to chat with me about in a few minutes. What I thought at first was, this is just an outgrowth of most of my Orthodox Christian countries were under communist rule in the 20th century. You know, all but two of them, I think Greece and Cyprus, were the only ones that were not under communist rule. The rest of them, Russia, Bulgaria, Romania, etc. These countries were all under communist rule. I just thought, oh, this is just an artifact of that problem. So I will assure your listeners that the referee for our paper was quite interested in every possible explanation for our results other than the one that we think we had, which is religion might actually matter. And so we got to explore all of them during the refereeing process.
I want to ask the one that jumped out at me was Hinduism.
Yep.
And, you know, as I scratched my head and thought about that, I said, well, you know, if you had to point to a Hindu country on the map, you point at India.
Yes.
And I, you know, don't know how many other countries have a large Hindu majority. And so when I looked at that Hindu result, I would say, well, is this really an effect of British colonialism? Because the Brits have their hands on India by this point in time, and they're the ones that are creating the institutions rather than, you know, the indigenous Indian population.
I don't think we're picking up a British effect, and the reason I don't think we're picking up a British effect is because in addition to the GDP variable and the religion variables, we also included their dummy variables, again, 0-1 variables, but economists like to give them a fancy name of fixed effects.
Mm, yeah.
Right? So we included fixed effects for what continent your country is located on. So we tried to have a very broad geographic control. In addition to these GDP predictions based on latitude, we also had a dummy variable for each continent, Africa, South America, North America, so forth. And then we also had a set of dummy variables for who might have colonized you between 1800 and the present. So what we did then was if your country was ever subject to the control in that time period of another country, then we had a dummy variable controlling for that. So if you were part of the British Empire between 1800 and 2000, we had a control in there for that. So I think any British effect would have been picked up by having been a British colony. That's also why I'm not that worried that our Orthodox Christianity findings were about communism, because we had controls for having been part of the USSR, as well as a control for having been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it turns out that much of the Austro-Hungarian Empire ended up being behind the Iron Curtain after World War II. So I don't think it's purely a British effect. Now, the other thing I need to emphasize is that we did not weight our observations in this paper by the size of the country. So India is clearly the largest Hindu country. I would guess that the vast majority of Hindus in the world live in India. But there were three other countries in both years, 1900 and 2000, that also had a largest religious group being Hindu. So one was India. Obviously, then there was Nepal, and the third one that in both years was plurality Hindu, was a little island country in the Indian Ocean called Mauritius.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then in 1900, the fourth country that was, you know, more Hindus than anyone else was Suriname, which is in South America. And in 2000, Suriname had gone, I think, Catholic. But the other country that was more Hindu than anything else was right next door to Suriname, which was Guyana. And so there was this influx of Indian migrants into Suriname and Guyana that impacted the number of Hindus in those countries. So in both 1900 and 2000, there are four countries that are predominantly Hindu. The group in 1900 is the one that we found the significant results for, and that was India, Nepal, Mauritius, and Suriname. So you were asking me if it's an India effect. My suspicion is it's actually a Mauritius effect. Mauritius is a stunningly well-run little country for being in the middle of the ocean with no natural resources. It's very prosperous given what's going on. I don't know whether that has anything to do with religion or not.
Yeah, you have to be really well run if you're in the middle of nowhere, because otherwise nobody's going to come to visit you and
exactly,
trade with you.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I need to do some additional work on Hinduism. I actually have an undergraduate student right now that I have tasked with kickstarting my knowledge about Hinduism historically and India and so forth. To date right now, what I've done is taken these findings that we have from the paper on rule of law, that Protestant and Catholic countries have very high rule of law, Orthodox countries are very low, Hindus seem to be higher than others, Islam is lower. These findings that we have, I'm now saying, okay, we've got some what economists like to call stylized facts, right? Here's something that may be true that mm-hmm. we're going to try to explore and figure out why this happened, right? I'm not happy just pointing and saying, well, it's because of Protestantism or Catholicism. I want to know more specifically how we got there.
Yeah, and this is what opens the door to the micro-analysis. And exactly. Actually, I just got to ask a side note question here. Do you consider yourself more of a macroeconomist or microeconomist?
I am without question a microeconomist.
That's what I thought.
I feel like I'm almost flailing around when I'm trying to do the macro work. The kinds of things I've decided to take on in this project require a micro-level understanding of things. It requires a macro-level understanding of things. It requires an understanding of history. It requires an understanding of law. And I don't know anybody who is good at all of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to unfairly cast you as a macroeconomist as we've done this early on.
That's probably one of my problems in doing this. Yeah. I'm not a macroeconomist. I have to pick the brains of my colleagues who are macroeconomists as I trudge through this.
Yeah, but you do it very well, and we have a few minutes left before we close out here, and you've already dipped your finger into speculating about some of these stylized facts with another paper that you did with Carl Gwynn, and that takes you back into history, as you say, one of the other pools that you have to dip your toes into. Tell us a little bit about what you think is going on and kind of summarize that work that you've done with Carl Gwynn and how it relates to this paper.
So what I picked out of our paper that I've just described to you as a springboard into the next project was the distinction between Western and Eastern Christianity. So I decided to see if there were something in the nature of Western versus Eastern Christianity that might have impacted the rule of law. So I went out and found some in the legal scholarship they call them jurisprudence books, how did the law come to be kind of books, and as well as economic growth books. So I tried to steep myself a little bit better in the economic growth literature than I already had. And what I settled on was an explanation that I think would make your political scientist heart go pitter-pat.
Oh, there's many things that do that, so let's see if this one does.
So what I think happened was essentially that around about the 11th century, so, you know, 1000 and change, the Catholic Church went through a reformation under a series of popes, the most prominent of whom was Gregory the VII. And there were pretty sizable reforms. That's where we get the vow of chastity and the vow of poverty, and certain orders came up back then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, in part, an attempt by the church to stem the tide of local princes and kings and whoever they were taking land from the church. The church was the largest landholder in Europe. And so this was something that I think I knew, but I didn't really know. But there was a time around 900 A.D. where the church owned about a third of the productive land in at least, you know, Germany, France, Italy, that part of Europe. And so the rulers of these little principalities around there were nipping away at it, essentially taking it away from them. The best example of that happening in full force was when Henry VIII took the whole stinking church from them.
Yeah, and he couldn't.
1520. But he did that. Versions of this had been happening for 500 years.
Yeah, it was easy for Henry VIII to do that because he was on an island, and I guess the Pope couldn't swim very well to
That's
take
right.
it back.
And he had an army, and the Pope was going to have trouble doing anything about it. But so in an effort to stave off the slowly emerging nation states of Western Europe, and I think at the time period I'm talking about, they are not emerging, right? We're talking about lords and kings and princes of small principalities. who were nipping and tucking away at pieces of land that belonged to the church and using them to build their own personal wealth and support their feudal estates. So the problem is that at this point in time, there really isn't a very well-developed legal system of any sort at all. And around this time, they rediscovered in the West Justinian's codes. Justinian was a Byzantine emperor around the 6th century. And they tried to make some sense of that. And so they took the scholastics, the medieval Catholic scholars within the church, basically tried to apply the systematic reasoning that the scholastics had developed to Justinian's codes. And it resulted in the emergence of canon law, law that governed the church itself. But the thing was, it wasn't just governing church affairs. They had canon law that dealt with contracts that the church entered into with people outside the church. Canon law governed the use of church property. Canon law governed the rights of students who were generally university students who were part of the church, the rights of students as they traveled from place to place, the rights of clerics as they traveled from place to place. And so you had all of these rules that started to emerge around about 1,000 to 1,050 and over the next 100 to 150 years. The Catholic Church was probably the strongest and most well-developed legal system in Western Europe. And it had the benefit of being continent-wide, as opposed to being one little principality with its set of rules and another little principality with their set of rules. You had a single body of law that governed basically from Italy all the way to England and from Spain all the way to Germany.
And I would guess because the Eastern Orthodox churches were more easily captured by these princes and kings that they weren't able to develop this code of law because they're basically at the whim of the king and the prince.
That's basically right. And the Eastern, you know, the Byzantine Empire was still there. So the emperor was much stronger in the East than any of the rulers were in the West. The church was much better organized in the West in terms of hierarchy and especially in terms of crossing borders. In the East, it really developed that each political entity had its own Orthodox Church. So there was the Greek Orthodox Church was the Byzantine Empire. There's a Cypriot Orthodox Church. There's a Russian Orthodox Church. There's a Bulgarian Orthodox Church. So each of these churches is sort of coterminous in its geographic scope with the king that it served. And what I think happened in the West was part of what the church was doing was saying, we really need some rules that protect the church's property from the kings.
Yeah.
And the church also was the only place where you could go to law school. Right? If you wanted to go to law school, you went to the university, and the university was run by the church. And so even if you were studying secular law, you were educated in there at the same time and place as the canon lawyers. So the canon lawyers and Roman law lawyers, right, they were kind of educated in the same way. Their doctrines somewhat overlapped, and they learned from each other, and they drew on each other. So what I think happened was that the church was really the source of law for 100 to 150 years at least, from about 1050 to about 1200. And then probably you see the nation-state starting to emerge more, and their own courts become more important, so that certainly by 1400, 1500, the church law, the church courts are no longer the primary deciders of cases in Western Europe. But I think that the ideas that came out of those courts, the doctrines that came out of those courts, influenced the law that emerged in the rest of Europe. And one of the key factors was the church was trying to protect itself as a property holder from an arbitrary and capricious state.
The old hands off my stuff and junk thesis.
Exactly. So the key to it is the church had incentive to have hands off my stuff and junk thesis, and it had the capability to implement it. Now, that, as far as I can tell, doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. And it's possibly just the historical peculiarities of Western Europe that allowed this to happen. But whatever the reason for it, I think that the reason rule of law emerges in Western Europe, the reason we find that countries that were Protestant or Catholic 100 years ago have much higher rule of law today, than other countries do, is because of this story of Western Christendom developing its own legal code in an effort to protect itself from princes, came up with rules that protect property owners from an arbitrary state. And once these rules start to emerge, obviously it carried over into political philosophy much later that was completely separate from any church influence. But the ideas were nurtured back during the canon law era of the early medieval, the medieval period with the canon law courts.
Well, that is some absolutely fascinating research that dovetails nicely with and fills in a lot of the gaps, work done by Rod Stark and also Tim O'Coran, I think, as well, two of my favorite scholars on this topic. So we'll have to keep following along and see how this project develops and where you're going with it. And I also want to get you back to talk about some of these hot button issues, which we didn't get a chance to do today. So, but in the meantime, Chuck, it's been great having you on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks. I really enjoyed it, and I always enjoy talking to you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.